So, take the opportunity to open it up for questions and answers. If anybody has any questions about practice, teachings, path, yes.
I'm wondering about labeling thoughts. And do you find that helpful in your practice?
There was a time when I found it helpful. So that because it is helpful to be clear what is actually going on in the mind, and to actually state it so front and center. Oh, this is a confused thought. This is a thought of confusion. This is a thought of aversion. This is a thought of desire. So then, not going into the story, that's what's really helpful, because it helps to sort of cut the story. Because I was just saying, like, that thing, that what I mentioned of delighting in non-complication, because as soon as you make it clear, then that helps to cut that impulse in the stream of thought, and that's very useful. Where it can be not useful is when we get obsessed with making sure we have a label, and then not just a label, the right label. And so then, we turn it into something that is not non-complication. So it's a very useful tool that you have to learn how to use. So it's like, you're learning to skillfully work with the mind. So it's a skillful tool that is, it can be very helpful. But then to just be alert to the habits of the mind that we take something good, and it's like the that hammer looking for nails everywhere.
Afterwards, and it seems to be a part of tracking the breath. Is that something that you should recognize as a trying to control your breath or something to that effect?
Well, a lot of it's around the result, in the sense of whatever we're doing. It doesn't, because there isn't necessarily, there's how do you say, you don't ha there isn't a textbook on how to breathe. It's something that we do. But then you can also modulate the breathing sometimes to help the mind be a bit more present. You can use use the breath in a way that you're breathing deeply and letting it suffuse the body in a way that relaxes and or brings up alertness. So it's how what result comes from it. So you have, but you really do want to be attentive to, well, what is the result, and is it leading to increased awareness, increased well-being, increased settling and tranquility. So then those are kind of guidelines. So if it's turning into again, an obsession of getting it right, or it's starting to create a certain agitation of it's a bit too long or a bit too regulated, then just learning how to really relax and let the breathing find its own rhythm. So with meditation and practice, it's a it's an exploration, the investigation of, well, what works and what doesn't work? What worked yesterday and isn't working today? What's not working now, but what can I seed for in the future that's going to work? So that it's not a fixed thing, and you're learning as you go. So I think that just taking an interest in the process of how we cultivate awareness, clarity, tranquility, understanding, discernment. Okay. 'Cause it isn't something that you, if you just get the method right, then all of a sudden wisdom and light is just going to appear. It's just we have to be engaged in that process, and it has to you have to learn from it, and it has to resonate with the heart. Yeah.
You spoke of experiencing the breath,
yeah,
and experiencing feelings and the mind.
Yeah.
So are you suggesting that we experience the mind knowing the breath, or experience the mind when it's doing other things?
Especially in terms of what I said this morning in particular, it's actually in conjunction with the breath. These are basically, I was quoting or summarizing the instructions that the Buddha gave on mindfulness of breathing. There's one particular discourse where the Buddha outlines kind of 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, and they line up with the four foundations of mindfulness, so that to do with the body, to do with feeling, to do with the mind, and then to do with mind objects or the dhammas. And that's as one breathes in, as one breathes out, one's, say, experiencing the mind. And so that one is, because sometimes we think, if I could just be hold my mind on the breath, then I would nail this mindfulness of breathing bit. But the Buddha's approach to it is much more expansive, and you're learning about the experience of the body, the experience of feeling. And then how that affects the mind as well, in the sense of how the Buddha expressed it. It's like the experiencing the mind conditioners, which are feeling and perception. It's like perception being memory, association, and then pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling. Because those are inherent basically in every mental condition, and they're conditioning which way the mind is going to go, react, respond. So that coming down to a more root level of what's conditioning the mind, and then the experiencing the mind is sort of like, what kind of mood is in the mind? What kind of thought process is going through the mind as we're breathing in, as we're breathing out? It's like, and it isn't as if, like in the discourse on foundations of mindfulness that the Buddha gives, when it's the mindfulness of the mind, it's like one, there's a mind with greed, and one knows one has a mind with greed. There's a mind without greed, and one knows there's a mind without greed. And there's mind with with ill will or aversion, and you know that there's the mind with ill will aversion, there's a mind without ill will aversion, there's a mind with delusion without delusion, there's the scattered mind, there's the steady mind, there's the expanded mind, there's the contracted mind. So those are all kind of mental states and moods that we experience. But then having the breath, again, as a backdrop, that you can recognize that and notice it. Because it isn't like mindfulness of mind, and then I've got to make my mind perfect somehow, or I have to have my mind conform to some kind of ideal state. It's whatever's there, we have to learn what it is and recognize it, see it for what it is. So the breath is a great bridge for being able to highlight, well, what actually is going on in the mind, what is the mood of the mind. Yeah, Brock.
You were talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. I wonder about the fourth foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And is it as simple as the, say, for example, with the third foundation, I identify aversion, and then in the fourth foundation, I identify aversion as a hindrance.
That, you know, especially in terms of the sutta.
Well, in the sutta, it seems to give a whole lot of lists.
Yes, and I think, and that's how do you say what we've inherited. In our tradition, this is where sometimes the research that, say, Bhikkhu Anālayo, Bhikkhu Bodhi have been doing, researching the Chinese agamas and finding, okay, because they, some of those discourses they received before things were added to the Pali Canon. And so they're helpful, sort of see, okay. So then there's, because in the Chinese agamas, which quite closely parallel the scriptures, then there's like hindrances, Four Noble Truths. And it's going, okay, delighting in non-complication, right.
And then some other lists may have been added later.
Yeah. And it's not that they're wrong or bad or anything. It's just, you know, it's something else to be doing, and they're helpful. And some things resonate with others as well. But I think it's helpful to note that you know, there are other approaches, and we don't have to fit ourselves into everything that's there. But also, and you think in terms of the discourse that the Buddha gave on mindfulness of breathing, then the aspects to do with, say, Dhamma, mind objects, observations of truth, and it's basically impermanence, dispassion, cessation, ending, ceasing, and relinquishment, letting go. And so those are themes to attend to, just that you know, that paying attention to impermanence, inconstancy, as Ajahn Jeff translates, it's uncertainty, as Ajahn Chah often would translate it. And those are themes that are helpful for putting things in a different context of I've got to follow it. It's sort of, oh, you start noting, recognizing what it's doing, what its pattern is, what its characteristic is. And then that helps one to step back, that sense of dispassion or disenchantment, kind of a fading away of that kind of compulsion to follow or get caught up in. And that opens space for a settling and ceasing. Well, I mean, generally with judgment, then you're again, the sense of judging, particularly judging oneself, did I get it right? Did I get it wrong? Was this good? Was this bad? So those are things that we tend to, and then we evaluate ourselves on that sense of, well, I was successful, I was a failure on that. this went well, that went terrible. Whereas, say, the discernment, it's not that one doesn't recognize, because, I mean, yeah, we're constantly going through a process. Some things work, some things don't. But the Buddha's way of maybe measuring or discerning is much more around, is it useful, is it not useful? Is it beneficial, not beneficial? And then, well, how do you decide what's useful and what's beneficial? Okay, it's back to the Four Noble Truths. Did this increase suffering and complication and difficulty, or did it decrease that? And did it increase well-being and stability, clarity? Or did that decrease? So those are the context for discernment is much more around those. Yeah, useful, not so useful, beneficial, not so beneficial, skillful, not so skillful, as opposed to, yeah, right, wrong, good, bad. The human tendency in general, the Western tendency in particular, is we're really great on black and white. The different shades of gray we don't really pay much attention to. And so then, you know, we slot ourselves into category, and that's where that judging goes, and trying to fix it into a very clear one or the other category. And so that learning how to be comfortable with the with uncertainty in that sense of, well, yeah, I just have to watch this process for a while to see where is this going? Because that's all, like with, like often, yeah, how oftentimes how we feel about things we'll feel this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is right, this is wrong. But then, this is suffering, this is happiness. But then the Buddha says, well, there's suffering that leads to more suffering. There's suffering that leads to happiness. There's happiness that leads to suffering. There's happiness that leads to more happiness. So you've got to pay attention to that process to see, well, where's this going? And how am I involved in this? So you start paying attention to causal processes and the conditioned nature of things, as opposed to, because that judging tendency tends to be fixing things in some binary categories. And give some space for spectrums of experience. Yeah.
A question about how to handle physical sensations when you're meditating, like an itch that comes up. If all of a sudden you have an itch, is it best to just try to notice it and hope that it passes, or to just deal with it?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, it's helpful to notice it and hope that it passes. But I can pretty much guarantee it'll be an impermanent phenomenon. But how long it's there is another thing. So sometimes it's this is getting to be a distraction. So then, it's fine. But then placing that mindfulness of saying, okay, it's like an itch. It seems to be going on longer than normal. And I'm getting distracted by it. And you know, I think I'll scratch it and relieve that discomfort, and then come back. So trying to apply mindfulness throughout that, whereas as opposed to one experiences it, oh my God, it's itchy, I gotta deal with it right now, and that compulsion. But then developing a certain patience with discomfort, but one doesn't have to be stupid about it, or too kind of gung ho, push your way through it all the time. Right? Some discomfort, because sometimes your body is actually telling you something. I'm quite uncomfortable right now. Help me out here. So then taking the time to investigate or to watch it, but it's quite all right to respond to that in a mindful way. See what happens. Yes.
And it's saying that we're really only 10 to 20% human DNA, the rest is all bacteria, viruses, stuff, things living on our skin, and how they can affect our mood. It also says that for every one message that the brain sends the gut through the vagus nerve, the gut sends 7 back. So maybe not the brain that's running the show. And I'm wondering, my understanding is the Buddha encourages us to investigate, to not just take things up. I'm kind of wondering how this fits in. Because they're just discovering all this now.
Right.
And, of course, I don't know if... there's many, many things today that we do that they did in ancient times that they had no idea why they were doing it, but...
Yeah.
But now we know why.
Well, I think that certainly lines up with not self. Yeah, the Buddha kind of had that nailed. So that sort of recognizing the what we tend to identify, as me, as mine, as I am. Might be a lot more squishy than we assumed, and of course the Buddha didn't articulate it in terms of vagus nerve and bacteria and whatnot. But there certainly are these encouragements to investigate the nature of the body, and that there are processes of the body that are interacting and creating feeling, sensation, perception, and then throwing out different moods and reactions, so that to be able to and to develop some clarity around that, so we're not just being dragged around by our moods and reactivity. So it definitely lines up. And then in the end, to see this as a process of nature rather than some autonomous being that is sort of complete in itself and we have control of, like forget that.
Referred to him as being green.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about the struggle that monks have to go through, not getting enough food, considering that the gut is controlling the brain.
Yeah. No, really. I mean, that's one of the. But that's it's also part of, you know, we take it on as a part of our training and as a. As a part of the path of cultivation and making ourselves completely dependent on the generosity and the goodwill of other people, so that there's other benefits that come from that. Other than being healthy, you know, which is, I mean, you don't want to. And the Buddha actually says, if you're in a place where your alms food is not sufficient, but your practice is going very well, and your wholesome qualities increase, unwholesome qualities decrease. You don't have to be in a rush to leave. But if you're in a place where your alms food is not sufficient, and you're experiencing health problems and meditation is not going well, then you should leave. And, even if people are begging you to stay, then you do have to look after yourself. Yeah, it just doesn't work. So you've got to figure out what's sustainable, and there are times when for myself, I've been in places where the diet wasn't at all helpful for my well-being, and it was. I spent a whole rainy season, about 4 or 5 months, in a very beautiful area, really suitable for solitude and place of nature. So my meditation was going great, but it was very remote, along the border of Burma. It was at a mine site. The owner of the mine had tasked the cook at her house office place. She'd only come in from time to time, the owner, and then when I first got there, the villagers were kind of excited to have a monk, so they offered quite regularly. And it's a mine site, so. I mean, I don't know about, mine, generally miners, mine sites, kind of rough. So the same was along the border areas of Thailand. So they got, their enthusiasm waned pretty quickly. And then the cook was pretty young, and she'd never really seen a Westerner before, and she figured, he can't eat Thai food. So every day I got sort of plain rice and a plain fried egg omelet. And that was what she offered in my bowl every day, except the days when she slept in. Then I'd get a can of fish. took me years after to be able to look at eggs. But anyway, during that time, I wasn't getting vegetables or fruit or anything. So I got lots of energy from my meditation, but then my body wasn't doing so well. And what really kind of triggered it off was that I lost vision in one of my eyes. So okay, I should do something about this. So when I tried out some, you know, kind of, I didn't have much, so I just tried out a couple herbal things or do this or do that. Nothing helped. So after a week, I thought, oh, I should probably let them know that I'm not well and should probably see a doctor. And so then, but it's very remote, so I let the people know. And by the time a car came, it was another week to get out of the, you know, before there was a vehicle. So anyway, it ended up being some weird, like, viral infection in the iris of my eye that was from, like, through lack of proper nutrition. And
were you young?
Yeah.
That you would wake up?
Yeah, I was young and stupid. Yeah. You know, you're a young monk, kind of gung-ho, and yeah, and a guy, yeah. It's a guy thing. Well, then it was funny when I came back. I had to go to Bangkok, get treated, and then came back to continue. And then before I could go in, again having to wait for a vehicle to go in, the mine vehicles to go in, and then the abbot of the monastery was staying and waiting. He was asking me what was going on, and so I told him, when they came to pick me up to take me in to the back to my retreat place, then he really blasted the owner of the mine and said, "Do you know what's happening?" And she, "No, I told the cook to, you know, to offer food," and so then. My diet dramatically improved after that. The thing is it was an incredibly beautiful place, really, really suitable for practice. I ended up after that developing a retreat place that is still there. Along the border of Burma, and we ended up, what happened was, though there was a series of tin mines in the area, then, you know, that was my sixth year as a monk, so then in my ninth year I was asked to become the abbot of the International Monastery, and then stayed and training people there. And then after I'd been there for some, I just kept thinking, you know, it'd be nice to take the monks out and have them experience this place of wilderness, because it really was like elephants and tigers wilderness, and take them out there and let them experience it. And I knew already that the whole tin market had collapsed in Thailand, so the mines had shut down. But went back, and then another one of the mines had stayed, even when the market collapsed, because she was concerned about protecting the forest. And the area around where I had originally stayed, there was a little bit left, but a lot had been, because the tin market collapsed, then people came in and were destroying the forest outside then. But another 6-7 kilometers further in, basically right on the border, then that was completely protected. So ended up taking the monks there every year, and then we ended up making a monastery so that there would be a constant presence, and we've since been able to basically protect that whole area. Yeah.
And is that just for monks?
It's very difficult to get in. So lay people do go in and practice, but it tends to be, how do you say, it's hard to just show up there. The road is so bad, and exactly. So there's a real motivation not to fix the road up. And of course, then over the years, then I go and visit from time to time, and then it was just this past winter, the winter before I went in. It was absolutely delightful because going in, these terrible roads, and you come up a really big mountain, and you start coming down, and there used to be little roads going off to the sides, which were animal poachers, as well as log poachers, and they're all overgrown. And so the area that's protected is, I don't know, 10,000 acres, 20,000 acres, 30,000, it's hard, you know, it's hugely extensive. And the wildlife, it's rare to come across a place that the wildlife is so... protected. So it's sort of like, again, that's where you have, there's suffering that can be the cause for a happiness.
Did Ajahn Sona go on one of those trips with you?
He did. Yes. Yeah. We were all skinny then.
I have one more question just concerning the lack of food. In that situation that you were in, where you weren't getting enough food, mm-hmm. had you been a little older and smarter, would you have been able to, knowing that there was an abundance of vegetables, etc., around? Would you have been able to?
It's not really allowed unless the lay people make an invitation. Say if there's anything anything you need, anything that please. It's like making an invitation for requisites and. So as long as that invitation isn't there, and people tend to have to be a bit clued in to do that, because that's part of our, what you're doing is making yourself available to the generosity of people rather than trying to organize things so you get it the way you want. And sometimes there's ways that you can speak that are appropriate, but you're not kind of leaning too heavily on people. so that there's skillful ways of doing it, as an older, more experienced monk, then I would have been able to do that, a bit more skill then. Yes.
Could you say something about being with the fact that extreme hardship exists in the world?
I think one of the there's a teaching that the Buddha gives where he said there's people who their path is one of difficulty and hardship, but there is quick penetration, quick understanding. There's people who their path of practice is is fraught with difficulty, but insight is slow. There's people who their path of practice is one of ease and well-being, and their insight and penetration is slow. And then there's a path of practice of, that is of ease and well-being, and penetration is quick, is fast. So, you know, that's it's a yeah. There are it's like there's no inherent virtue in difficulty and hardship. You know, it's not intrinsically good or noble to make yourself miserable or to experience hardship. But sometimes has to be a recognition that yes, you know, it is an aspect of say experience as in the human condition. Also, another say perspective or reflection on it is also one of the teachings that the Buddha gave of, say, the eight worldly conditions or eight worldly winds, so that praise and blame, gain and loss, say, fame, respect, disrepute, and happiness and suffering. So those are inevitable in the world. Whether you're a monastic, whether you're a layperson, whether you're a fully enlightened Buddha or regular person living in the world, those are always going to be conditions that are experienced and are in a, they have an uncertain nature about them by their very condition. So that, you know, even the Buddha, after his awakening, experienced times of hardship. There's an account where the Buddha, with his group of monks with him, were invited to spend the rains retreat at a particular place, and then famine struck there, and toward the end of the rains retreat, they were basically eating, having to eat like horse feed, cattle feed, pound it up, make it somewhat edible, and that, even the Buddha experienced that. I mean, so conditions change in the world. Or where the Buddha is criticized and blamed for something. If the Buddha is going to experience something, to have that hope that somehow we're just going to experience bliss, happiness, float to Nibbana on a nice purple cloud. I mean, it's not going to be like that. There's this constant change. So it's how we receive it and how we, in a contemporary time, 20th century Thailand, the vast majority of really revered teachers, meditation masters, are from the northeast of Thailand. And they come from a region and an era of great difficulty. The northeast of Thailand's always been the poorest part of Thailand. They have to put up with uncertain crops. Weather's kind of harsh. Either you're getting flooded out, or it's a drought, or it's bitter cold, or you're getting roasted. And But that kind of hardship and difficulty, there's a certain tenacity that is a part of their cultural conditioning that they've grown up with and been a part of since they're little, so that applying that to their practice, plus the fact that the region is actually very steeped in kind of faith and devotion to Buddhism, then it's one of the results is, you know, plethora of really great teachers. And you know, other parts of Thailand are kind of, you know, it's very comfortable, it's always more than enough food, and everything is kind of comes pretty easily. Like when it's quite interesting, like when for Ajahn Chah teaching and starting to a community growing around him, and more people wanting to train with him, monks, nuns, lay people, then there were more Westerners who came to train with Ajahn Chah than Central Thai, Southern Thai. It's quite interesting. Am I? So it's just this is a kind of an interesting reality that it was just the idea of, especially from, say, like in Thailand, if you're from any of the other parts of Thailand and you're, say, a civil servant or you're, you know, working in some company. Yeah, and if you mess up, then you're just going to get sent to the northeast of Thailand, kind of banished. that kind of familiarity and non, say, it's not daunted by, you know, a bit of difficulty, then it's a real benefit to practice. I mean, as I said, there isn't any inherent virtue in difficulty and hardship, but it can temper us quite well if we use it skillfully. Yeah. I think one of the things of being with somebody who is passing away is to learn how to be present for them, to learn how to listen, to learn how to be present. Sometimes it's uncomfortable or a bit intimidating maybe to be around somebody who is dying, and there can be a lot of projection or our own kind of fears. So learning how to listen and be present for them, really important. And there's a great story that Ram Dass relates of him, of course this is a long time ago, but his stepmother was passing away. I think it was his stepmother. And she's passing away, and he's fired up on his spiritual path and religious seeker, leader type religion. And so it made him anxious to be around somebody who was actually dying, and then, you know, trying to do something, trying to give some kind of teaching, some kind of guidance, some kind of advice as she's passing and she's laying there, I can't remember what his name is now. The, his actual, not Ram Dass, some of his. That's right, Richard. Yeah, so then, she's laying there with her eyes shut. Richard, Richard, be quiet. You know, so it can be well-meaning, but it is a kind of agitation that's really underlying it, or a dis-ease. So that learning how to be comfortable, not saying anything, just being present for somebody. And then you realize, once you're really open and present, then you can respond to that, or see a bit more clearly what the need is, or what would be useful. And sometimes it doesn't actually require any words. Sometimes it's helpful to have words. Sometimes it doesn't require, just to hold their hand, to be present, hold their feet. Just that touch is something that is important. So that those are sort of aspects of reflection, to see what is. You start to intuit for oneself, well, what might be useful, and then tune in and say, well, was it useful? And but I think one of the things that's really important is to really lift up in the mind one's own, you know, a feeling of either anxiety or fear or dis-ease around the dying process, because oftentimes it triggers our own feeling of you know, not being so comfortable with that. And the more we're able to be comfortable with that reality, then the more we have to give. Probably was. He gave advice on lots of things. But it's not sort of popping up into my mind immediately. But certainly there were certain aspects of, like, looking after a sick monk, then it needs to be somebody who is comfortable with the pain and discomfort of somebody else, comfortable with bodily fluids, you know, able to deal with that kind of the messy nature of a failing human body, and compassion, is loving kindness and compassion have to be well established. I remember these are some of the qualities of a good nurse, and looking after for monks, looking after sick monks. Yeah.
So when you talk about conditioning, I don't know if that's right or not, but is the idea, when you find that you discover in yourself that unwholesome things are coming and you're getting pleasure, or vice versa, your aversion is not for useful things, to recondition somehow?
Yeah, to a certain degree, yeah. It's not quite as linear as the Pavlovian conditioning, but, it's a little more nuanced and complex, because it's just the nature of reality. But we set in motion certain conditions that we respond to, and it becomes a habit, and it's a well-worn path in our mind. We oftentimes don't think about it or even realize it. So then, we need, on a certain level, we need to condition, retrain how we respond to certain external condition or to the internal conditions of the mind.
There's an aspect of the Buddha's, I guess, character or teaching that seems to come through really strongly, which is having had the talent to know not just that he knew a lot of true things, but he had this talent for knowing precisely the thing to say to this person at this moment.
Yes.
And it seems to be part of the... seems to be a characteristic of that is developed in the teaching Ajahn's, you know, that, the ability to answer, you know, appropriately to the person. I've never heard a monastic talk about how that is developed. I've never heard it referred to as part of the training, and yet it seems to be such.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly that is a wonderful and inspiring quality of the Buddha, and an inspiring quality of good teachers, and, you know, in terms of developing it, I think it's again depends on personality. I mean, there's and experience, because when you get it wrong, you usually get a feel for it, or you hear about it after how badly that went. So, okay, it didn't work. And you're as a, say, as a teacher, you're trying to respond to the person themselves as a, and often, you know, really when you're if you come across somebody and there's lots of them around in terms of teachers and people who are, aspire to be teachers, who, they either respond from a book learning or from a kind of ideal of what they think they should be, or an ideal they think of the person should be, and, you know, that rarely works. And certainly my own models were Ajahn Chah, that's who I was close to most. And, you know, I feel he was a really exceptional example. And you can't just model somebody and do that. Again, it really falls flat when you're just trying to give a pat answer that you heard somebody else give. You have to be... There's a certain, because it's a part of practice and training for oneself. You know, as one... It's not like meditation and you're just sitting on your cushion. And it's like meditate, because when you're responding to somebody else, you're responding to the condition of suffering. And it's mirroring oneself. So you have to tune into oneself. So there needs to be a certain humility and relinquishment of self in order to respond most appropriately. So that's a part of practice and training that you can continue to be developing as a meditator, as a practitioner. So it's you're taking it on as part of a training, and so you're learning more about yourself, because that, you know, certainly just like that when as a monk, first time you have to be with somebody who is dying, the first time you have to be with somebody who is really sick, and or is in a terrible state because of some catastrophe that's happened in their life, and you're completely intimidated by it, and you realize I'm got a clue, and I don't even know what I would do, let alone advise somebody else, so that hits one, and you start realizing, okay, that's my own limitation, that's my own self that's getting in the way. How do I keep relinquishing that? How do I let go of that? And so that the more we can let go of our own self-position and our own, investment in... Because there's a real humility that has to come with that. Our own, self-image. Then the more you release that, the more available you can be for people. And hopefully some kind of answer comes out of that. and sometimes it does. And also sometimes, somebody asks you for some assistance or advice or something. And sometimes you have to be with, I don't know, I'm got a clue. But then you can explore it together sometimes. As soon as you do that, then you can explore it together sometimes. So I'm saying, I haven't got a clue what to do. But, let's think about this a bit. Yes? It's in retrospect,
So I guess I was wondering if you have any suggestions for that initial step of
noticing. Well, I think one of the things is, just being reflective and investigating, how does that present it, like that sense of protecting of self-image? How does that present itself? How does that feel? And both on an emotional level, or what's the impulse? How does it feel physically? Does it feel, contracted, or even just a little disease, or something like that? So it's like tuning in, because the more mindfulness and attention that we pay, we can start recognizing the nuances of our impulses and reactions that come up, and then the cascade of different emotions that it's associated with, and so then we can start to recognize that a bit more clearly, a bit more quickly. And then again, developing kind of response, and it's just, and the kind of like letting go, relinquishment is just giving some space around it to cease. It's not getting rid of, and especially because it's like relinquishment of self is impossible from a Buddhist perspective, because the self didn't exist in the first place. We've conjured it up out of thin air and keep it propped up, so like keeping those balls in the air. And but then once you sort of realize, I keep propping that up. So it's a lot of it is just, okay, I don't have to feed it anymore. Wow, what a relief. Okay. Once all the balls have fallen down, now what do I do? Great. There's a lot of space opens up. Yeah?
I know in my meditation, I just have one of these thinking minds, you know, and over the years I'm learning more and more to just to watch where my thoughts go and all the machinations that I'm getting more and more comfortable with that. At the same time, I've heard teachings about as you can improve your concentration, you know, on the primary object of breath, then your mindfulness increases as well. And so, I'm trying to go back to the concentration.
It's kind of a symbiotic relationship, and there's a certain danger in that. Because as soon as you say, like, I'm going to improve my concentration, you know, I need more concentration, what do you feel? It's immediate tension. And it's tightening up. I got to get concentrated. And, you know, that's an obstacle right there. Which is kind of a legacy of the early translators of Buddhism, and the same word that's translated as concentration in English, when it's translated in Thai, it's translated as like the firm establishing of the mind. There's a different feel to it, doesn't it? Okay, I just firmly establish that, settle that. So there's different words that we might want to use, say like settling, which is just as valid, and it expresses maybe a bit more clearly what it feels like to, you know, to put attention on and to sustain attention. So it's just a settling, a firm establishing. Or even just like a giving oneself to the object, you know, which is then it's an offering that one is doing rather than something that one is trying to get concentrated. And so the language, you know, conditions us and to be attentive to, you know, what triggers it. And especially with, you know, as soon as we're a bit, say, tense or tighten up a bit, then, you know, we want to fix it. And the way we fix it is through our conceiving mind. And then it gets that thought process that's kicked in, you know, quite well. So it's just playing with those concepts and recognizing, oh, there's another approach to this. So we can work with this in a different way. But it's true that as the mind, the heart becomes more comfortable with being settled, then the compulsion for thinking drops off. And a lot of it is also one of the qualities that is required, say, from the Buddha's teaching, and just a set of teachings that he gives that are like a particular qualities that are essential for the mind to become settled or to experience samadhi. The very first one is called chanda in the scriptural language, and what it literally means, desire. And oftentimes we think, I've got to get rid of all my desires because I'm a Buddhist. And the Buddha says, desire is the cause of suffering. Which is true, but there's two different words for desire. So one is say, like in the Four Noble Truths, tanha is the cause of suffering. It's desire. And it's always, I would say, it's inextricably linked with greed, hatred, delusion, attachment, clinging. So it's always going to end up in suffering and stress. Whereas a quality that's essential for cultivation and growth is chanda, which is desire. And it's more like a desire, like, well, wholesome desire, motivation. Oftentimes I'll translate, especially in terms of meditation, interest. I'm really taking an interest in that process. There's a kind of a curiosity and desire to understand and know, how does this work? How do I do this? What works? What doesn't work? And so then that's a motivating factor that leads one into, say, application of effort and settling. Okay, one more question.
I'm really curious, and thank you so much. Did Buddhism find you in northern Manitoba, or did you leave Manitoba, and what led you to Buddhism?
I left northern Manitoba, I left Canada, I left... There was not much Buddhism in northern Manitoba. No temple to go to. No, I was. I didn't really know of Buddhism. I mean, this is. I grew up in the, in the 60s as I get my teens, and then went off to university about 68, 69, something like that. And then. At university, even there, though, you know, it was University of Winnipeg, so wasn't that much happening. But I was able to. I did a course on Eastern religions because I was pulled to something, and I knew I was pulled to something, but I didn't know what it was. Through that exposure, then I was sort of everything else. Didn't really hit home very much. Buddhism immediately really hit home. So then I started exploring Buddhism. But then there was no way to further that. But it was all just my own reading. I never ever came across any meditation groups or anything like that, or any Buddhist teachings. I never really heard any instruction on Buddhism until I got to Thailand, and I had, after university, worked for a bit and got enough money to travel, and then traveled. And most of the book, or a lot of books that I'd read were about Japanese Zen. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm going to go to Japan and learn about Buddhism there. But then I took the long way around. Went to Europe first and traveled through Europe and overland. I still haven't made it to Japan. But I made it to Thailand. And as soon as you get there, then it's okay, there's Buddhism here. Okay, so there's, I think that's enough to keep people... going on that, but let's just have a period of sitting and take the opportunity to settle. Just again, seeding the mind with, you know, kind of, you know, the words that we use, the language we use affects us. So that sense of settling and to being alert, attentive. Okay, relaxing into the quality of knowing, taking the breath as an object.